Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined as always by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, North Korea, Iran, and American foreign policy. And Richard, as you and I are recording this, we are presently seeing things that we've never really seen before out of North Korea, where Kim Jong-un, the president, recently crossed the border for the first time for a meeting with his South Korean counterpart. And you've got Pyongyang talking about potentially abandoning its pursuit of nuclear weapons if the U.S. agrees to formally end the Korean War and forswear an invasion of the North. Richard, President Trump's defenders are already giving him a lot of credit for a breakthrough that no other president has mustered. How confident should we be, though, that we're going to see real change this time? And perhaps more importantly, what factors should we be watching to determine how confident we should be?
Well, I think we already have seen substantial change, even if nothing substantive comes out of this. When you start to change your rhetorical posture on matters of this particular importance, what everybody in the world has to do is to recalibrate the positions that they have towards you, towards your allies, towards your enemies, and to your friends. And he has only moved in one direction, and that's the opposite direction from which he moved somewhat earlier. And so if you were the Japanese and were trying to ask yourself whether you thought that ballistic missiles were going to be directed towards you, you would basically say the odds of that happening now are lower than they were before. That's going to influence the willingness that you have to get nuclear arms or to have a major buildup against them. If it turns out that you're China and you see all of this stuff, what you think is that, you know, our strategy probably have worked here. We've told him we don't want him to cave, but we don't want him to start a war, which will essentially destabilize everything along the East Asia coastline. If you're the United States and you're doing this, it's now a little bit easier for you to deal with South Korea, I think, because they are actually making some degree of progress. So things are going to be a little bit less unnerving. So the worst that can happen, I think, is that we go back to the dead standoff that we had before, and that's going to cost our friend Kim Jong-un a lot of prestige overseas in many ways. So I think, in effect, that even if we don't see everything executed, we have changed things. There's another thing, I think, which is extremely important, and this is an issue which is absolutely critical in international negotiation, which is the sequence of concessions. You never want to get into an arrangement which the United States entered into under Clinton and Obama, where you perform today and he promises to do something tomorrow, because, as we know, tomorrow never comes. But if you just think of something symbolic as the screaming loudspeakers on both sides of the DMZ, what they did is they simultaneously removed them. And so you don't have that particular problem of whether he's going to follow. It's also the kind of thing which, once you do it, since it's rather a public act, the only way you could renege on it is to renege on it publicly. So that's a change which I think the guy who decides to go back on it is going to have a lot of explaining to do. This is, I think, a form of reduction with respect to the tensions. The other thing I think that's driving him is mass starvation on his home base. The current system there needs to be liberalized. He can't be as stupid as all that to think that you can have a system of collective ownership of the means of production and avoid this. So what he's going to start to do is to allow a little bit of fictional privatization at the edges. You don't own the property, but you can farm it and keep it, wink, wink, nod, nod, and so forth, because he needs that. And the moment he starts to give some degree of liberalization, my view is he's going to have to give the people at home a little bit more wherewithal to do things. So the internal calculus is going to start to change as well. And so I will be reasonably surprised if everything you promise is going to go through. But I'll add this last point. What Kim Jong-un is asking for, the United States not to invade North Korea. Now, put yourself in the position of Trump. Does anyone in his right mind want to invade North Korea? I'm quite willing to make that particular deal. We won't do something that we'll never do, and he will stop nuclear arms and give us inspections. And one of the reasons I'm thrilled to do it is, once you put North Korea to one side and you ask about the Iran deal, all of a sudden, May 15th or May 12th, it's a different deal. If the North Koreans are willing to talk about inspections, why not the Iranians?
I'm going to turn you to the Iran question in a moment, but I want to ask you one other thing about this first. You have been, as listeners of the show will know, a critic of the president's on many fronts, so you've also given him a lot of credit in areas where you think he's done well. Richard, if we go back to when President Trump was lobbing insults at Kim Jong-un over Twitter, there was at the time pretty widespread alarm that the president was recklessly escalating what was already a pretty volatile situation. There is now a kind of revisionist diagnosis of that going around that says, well, maybe this was a kind of strategic madness that is now paying dividends. Do the outcomes we're seeing, or at least the potential outcomes here, shade for you the way that you think about the kind of Trump bull in a china shop approach to diplomacy?
No, not as much as they might to other people. Let me explain why. First of all, I do think he has the capabilities when irked to being genuinely hysterical. I also think that most people now realize that the hysteria wears off fairly quickly, and so that there's more discounting now than there was at the time. But I think much more likely what has happened is you have to look in the change of his team. Tillerson and Kelly, I guess it was, or McMaster, I think. These were people who essentially were equivocators when it came to dealing with foreign powers. You put into place the current team of Pompeo and Bolton, and what you do is you have a bunch of guys who essentially believe that diplomacy and force have to be used together, and they have abandoned, I think, the sort of middling strategy that was done when Tillerson was around. And I also think it's a total and complete and absolute repudiation of what happened when our good friend Obama was in power. I mean, he wouldn't cross any red lines. Now, look who you've got. I also should mention Mattis. Mattis was fired by Obama because he was thought to be too aggressive. A mad dog, as somebody said. Well, you now have three of the best minds in the United States working on this. And my hope is that Trump is willing to listen to them. And the more it turns out there seems to be some break in the ice, I think the more willingness they're going to have to do this. And I also think that, you know, the two fields are interactive. Kim Jong-un, he looks around and he sees that the United States actually bombed the tar out of Syria in some limited but focused events. They also notice that the Israelis took out a bunch of operations there, and the Russians did nothing but denounce it. So who's calling whose bluff now? And what was always the case is American and Israeli forces and Saudi forces, if you want to put them all together, are clearly superior to the Russians and the Iranians if you're willing to use it. And now, in effect, what happens is we are basically playing a more aggressive game of poker. We're putting these on the chips on the table, and so far they've folded. So the two things, I think, are reinforcing one another, and I think Trump has to be given some credit, if only because he stood out of the way and got some people who knew what was going on and made them do it. I mean, his great strength as an executive is, strangely enough, is his willingness to fire when he doesn't think things are going well. Many people have too much personal sentiment, but when you're in jobs that are that important, you have to get the right team around you. And if he was starting to go for cronies as opposed to people who had established independent prior reputations, I would have been absolutely appalled. But this is not the case of taking Jared Kushner and making him Secretary of State. So on balance, I think he gets a lot of credit on this particular issue. I think the Democrats have been notoriously silent on this, and for very good reason. They don't have a lot to say. And I suspect that given what has happened now, they're going to keep this up. And my think is it's much more credible now to pull out of the Iranian deal than it would have been 6 months ago when you didn't have any strategy to follow up. Pulling out of that deal and being as passive as you were when you went into it would have been the total recipe for disaster. But now they've pushed a little bit harder. They've gotten some results. I think the Europeans, who always want to follow and never to lead, they will still be mouthing words in support of Iran. But I think the level of their opposition will go down, and they might even have some tacit support for what it is that he's doing. So I regard the external news as pretty good. It surprises me to some extent, but I basically am in support, moderately hawkish, of everything that's done. I think you've known this for a long time, Troy. You know, I wrote something in 2014 called The End of Pax Americana. Well, I think at this particular point, it's time to write a sequel.
All right. So as you and I are talking about this, we are a little less than 2 weeks away from when the president's going to have to make the decision on whether or not to pull out of this deal with Iran that was struck under the Obama administration. Do I take it from what you said just there, Richard, that you think he should pull out?
Well, I think what happens is you should make it very clear that he will pull out unless they renegotiate. And, you know, the, you know, trust but verify seems to me to be a maxim from the Reagan administration that carries over. And we have basically given them the complete run of the mill on that. I think you really have to do something with respect to the ballistic missiles that could carry these things. They may not be able to reach the United States, but it's not very far for them to reach part of Europe, to reach Israel, to reach Saudi Arabia and so forth. And we just don't want all that stuff happening. I also think that the Iranians are in a worse position because in terms of their domestic economy, the guys who are very good at waging holy wars are not so good at making sure that people get their food and their gasoline on time. And so inflation and all sorts of internal dislocation, I think, are going to be on the rise. And sooner or later, no matter how strong you want to posture politically, if you have a restive public, you're going to be in trouble. You'll look at Russia. My friend Paul Gregory, you know, reads the language and keeps on reporting about broken deliveries, trucker strikes and the like. One has to remember that Putin's vast economy is smaller than Italy. You're not talking about a hugely rich company. It's on the wrong side. And I think even he's going to have to recognize that if you have somebody who's willing to call you a bluff, he can play it over with. The biggest godsend that all of these characters had was the fact that Obama was president for 8 years, and he would not act unilaterally. This is a kind of a very difficult question because it turns out in international diplomacy, if you wait for Congress to act, nothing gets done. And so what we've done is we've had a kind of a revision of our constitutional order that the president could use these parries and these thrusts of one sort or another in Libya and perhaps, if necessary, in Syria or in Iran again, unless Congress intervenes to stop him. And those characters, they can't agree on lunch to put it together. The Congress is surely a they, not an it, when it comes to figuring out how to deal with international affairs. And that utter division and confusion is what has shifted the customary constitution to the point where the power to declare war is largely irrelevant when you start dealing with these kinds of limited engagements.
So for the most part, this is a pretty positive diagnosis of Donald Trump as a foreign policy president. Are there areas on foreign policy, Richard, though, where you consider him weaker than the ones we've been talking about thus far?
Well, sure. I think everybody regards the way in which he does foreign policy with respect to trade. You know, talking about national security issues when you want to impose various kinds of tariffs on steel and aluminum for Canada, for Mexico, for various parties in Europe, Japan, and so forth. What happens is if you're antagonistic to people on trade issues, they're not going to support you on political and security issues. And I regard all of that stuff as essentially an absolute gratuitous wound. He's saying, but if I do this, it's the same kind of hysteria I play everywhere else. I sound like a maniac. Everybody gets afraid. And then when I make a concession, they jump on board and I do better than if I had been sane all the time. The problem is everything that he wants to get in the international trade area is a mistake. He should be losing all of those kinds of things. He can tell his base perfectly sensibly. We've done the fundamental reforms at the tax level and so forth. There are now places all over the country which are begging for workers to come, giving them relocation allowances and the like. Unemployment stuff is down. And where it's high, it's not because of anything that's happened at the United States. It's because of the basket type economies that you have in places like Illinois, where they never met a regulation they don't like. And if he says all of that stuff, I think people will be perfectly happy because what he says turns out to be true. So I don't even think he has a political problem that he has to face on this if he sells it correctly. But he does have a foreign affairs problem, and I think he has to be able to stop that. Other things, I think, well, how do you start dealing with the EU on a whole variety of issues having to do with military rearmament? I don't think he's done badly on that, but I don't think he's done particularly well on that. It's just an extremely difficult thing to sort to persuade people that essentially they cannot rely forever on an American umbrella, on American land presences and freeload. And I think he's trying to do that. He will make some kind of success on that. He's got Mrs. Merkel, who I think is basically at this point outlived her usefulness as a politician. Don't have much confidence in her. Macron, the French guy, well, hot and cold. I'm not opposed to him. Mrs. May, I think, is a real disappointment. I don't think she has the intellectual stature or conviction to be able to run this thing. She certainly has mangled the Brexit stuff. So it's not as though he's got a bunch of ideal trading partners or business partners in the European European Union with which he can do a kind of work. So I kind of give him an okay grade on that, because I don't think any of the mistakes that he has there turn out to be gratuitous errors. But all in all, the most important part of foreign policy is to make sure that you know when to use, when to threaten, when not to use, when not to threaten, the use of force. And I think on that particular issue, this new team actually seems to understand the landscape and to realize that we put enough stuff on the table and make it clear that we're going to come back a second time. These characters aren't going to go after us the first time. And, you know, are there still problems? Well, China's creating islands in the middle of the South China Sea. Everybody knows it's flatly illegal. So do the Chinese. The question is whether or not you're going to actually bomb those sites in order to take them out of business on the grounds that they have no business being there at all. I don't know what the answer to that question is. But I do know this, that what we have to do with respect to China is to make it clear to them that we want their aid on Korea, but they have want our aid on it to tell, but that they cannot engage in kind of systematic policies that threaten the use of force elsewhere in the Southeast Asia. And we also have on the trade issues to be much tougher, as I think we've been, on the sort of rampant theft of intellectual property, which is part and parcel of the Chinese situation. And what we have to do is not worry so much about tariffs and so forth and the like, but to make sure that they follow WTO rules and to sanction them more particularly if they don't. You know, I think somebody in this administration actually knows what's going on, and my hope is that the president will start to listen to them. I will say this. I don't think there was a chance, a Chinaman's chance, whatever expression you want to use in hell, that Mrs. Clinton would be able to do any of the right things. She would have inherited all the vices of the Obama administration, and we would have been far worse off today than we currently are.
All right. Thank you, Richard, and thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.